So tonight's Shapeshifter is a career banker, special envoy on investment to the president, and Jaco Marie, chairman of Liberty, deputy chair of Standard Bank, thought he was going to take it easy after stepping down as chief executive of Standard Bank and became an important deal maker for Standard Bank in his retirement. But you've suddenly been called to almost higher service, if you like.
Yes, Bruce, good evening. Yeah, it's national service in a sense. You know, I think all of us have some sense that our country is at a crossroads, and I feel that we were really thrown a lifeline in December,
yep,
with the political events, and I really felt that I was happy to contribute in some way, and I think there are many other people who feel the same.
There's that really famous World War One poster of Lord Kitchener with his big fat handlebar moustache, and he's pointing directly at whoever's looking at the poster saying, "Your country needs you." Did you have that sort of sense of "your country needs you" and the calling?
No, not really, but when the president had phoned and asked to see me...
Did he phone personally or did he send a secretary?
He phoned personally.
Well, you can't say no to, can you?
And I went to see him, and it seemed like a very reasonable request, you know.
And that reasonable request, and you're running out of time because the 5 years, I think, started 3 months ago, so you've got 4 years and 9 months. To come up with this notional target of $100 billion. And Martin Davies from Deloitte last night was saying between 1994 and 2016, South Africa drew $83 billion in FDI. And now we're looking for $100 billion in 5 years. It feels like a very big, hairy, audacious goal.
It certainly is. There's no question about that. Having said that, at least half the money one would think has to come from within the country, from companies and within South Africa. So we're probably looking for $50 billion of external investment. When I think back to one deal that I was involved in, which was the investment by ICBC into Standard Bank in 2007, that was $5 billion in one deal. So it's not completely unreasonable, but no, it is an audacious goal. And we are telling a complicated story. South Africa is not a simple story at the moment. We've still got quite a lot of loose ends, sure, that haven't been tied up, and it's not the easiest sell. But I must say I'm finding the discussions that I'm having with investors most interesting.
How do you do it? I mean, you've got a brand globally as a respected chief executive of a high-flight bank in South Africa, one that withstood the financial crisis, one that was very ambitious in its goals. You know people in governments around the world. You know people in corporations around the world. How do you make that first phone call to somebody and saying, "Hey, long time no speak. Can I come and have a chat?"
Well, of course, we were asked to use the networks that we,
sure,
have. But the obvious thing to do, in my mind, is to start to engage with people that have an interest in South Africa. So clearly you've got all the South African corporates that you, sure, can talk to. And then you have foreign multinationals that have subsidiaries here. And we are fortunate. There are hundreds and hundreds of companies owned by international companies operating here. You can think of most of the major brands, sure, around the world have local subsidiaries. And just talking to them about, people tend to think about brand new deals and new factories, but from an investment point of view, you know, capital expenditure, just improving your plant or adding a new line to the plant, all contributes to, sure, growing the economy. So it doesn't have to be brand new investment, and we are therefore starting to talk to people that have some interest already in South Africa.
Are you laying claim, for example, to Mercedes-Benz extra 10 billion rand investment in East London and their plant there? They've already got a substantial plant and they've made this big commitment to enhance that production facility. Can you lay claim to it?
We would love to. Unfortunately, that preceded us and predated us.
I mean, you've always been in leadership positions. You're a head boy of your school, and you did very well academically at university. You joined Standard Bank and you rose up through the ranks really quickly. Was it always in you? Your dad was a high performance guy who expanded Eskom many, many years ago in the days when power was cheap and plentiful. Was there always great ambition for Jaco Marie?
It's a difficult question to answer. I think, you know, you start your career and you of course have ambition, but you've got to keep a balance in life. And I was fortunate. I enjoyed what I did. I stayed with one company essentially my whole career, and my bosses were very good to me. I was fortunate. Always worked for great bosses who were keen to see me succeed. And Standard Bank is a wonderful company.
My history on this may be slightly ropey, but you were running the corporate and investment bank, and then Nedbank launched a hostile takeover. I think it was the year 2000 for Standard Bank, and the board just looked at this and went, "We need fresh blood in here to fight this off." And you were thrust into a really interesting position as a brand new young chief executive with a brand new management team to see off the voracious appetites of Richard Laubscher at the time who was running Nedbank.
Yeah, it was September 99, I remember.
September 99, okay.
Very well. Yeah. But, it of course, those sort of events are defining events for companies, actually, and of course, for individuals who involved. So, yes, we had a positive crisis. Standard Bank at the time had probably been resting on its laurels a bit.
What was wrong with Standard Bank? Was it just lethargic and hadn't done particularly anything new or interesting for a while? You had a great footprint. It was big. It was present. It was there. But you were vulnerable to a takeover.
Yes. A lot's been written about it. But, yes, I think Standard Bank wasn't in trouble or anything of that sort, but perhaps was seen as a little bit sleepy. And we were expanding into emerging markets at that time, and we had lost some money in Russia. People were saying, what was Standard Bank doing in Russia? We recovered the money subsequently, but by then the damage was done. We'd also had a sense that we'd overpaid to buy the Gordon family out of Liberty, because we took control of Liberty.
Yes.
And there'd been some quite high profile bad debts. Pepsi went bust, and we had an exposure there. So there were a few things, and at that time, Nedbank was the darling of the banking industry. So there was a tussle, and we survived.
You're underselling it a little bit. I mean, you were thrust from being the head of a very important division of the bank into the chief executive role with the task of building up the defenses and repositioning Standard Bank. I mean, it was a pivotal moment in the history of Standard Bank. Had you not succeeded, then Standard Bank, a division of Nedbank, or just lots of green banks around the place.
Exactly. It was a defining moment. And I think for a number of us who were involved in that, it obviously changes your career, and it might have turned out differently. You might have ended up working somewhere else.
But you built a really strong and resilient leadership team, and that core leadership team stayed together for your entire period as chief executive of the bank, mostly. Very, very strong, capable individuals.
Well, I think to run businesses, big businesses, one of the keys is getting the right team. There's some businesses, you know, that huge manufacturing plants, which are less dependent on people, but certainly in financial services, hugely dependent on people. And I think if you can get a team that functions well together, works well together, trusts each other, you can make magic and get things to happen. And you can see that in some of the very successful companies around the country today.
Mm. I mean, but it was a good baptism of fire, because it sort of forged very good, strong collegial relationships, which then stood you in good stead for the growth phase you went on then from 2000 to 2015. Or when it was 2015 when you retired?
2013.
Was it 2013? Is it that long ago?
It is, 5 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yes, I think getting the team together and also a positive crisis can be very good for a company. Normally, crises are negative things where people have to be retrenched and so on. A positive crisis that creates unity of purpose between the senior leadership and the shop floor, if you will, and the tellers and so on is incredible, and that stood us in great stead for 5 or 6 years.
I miss that good spirited fight. It was a fun time to be looking at the world of banking and all of that. Did you ever lie awake at night wondering if you were going to get it right, whether or not you were going to be the guy who will go down in history as sort of closing the door on Standard Bank? Did that ever worry you? Were you a confident street fighter?
No, I think. In complex situations, you can never be. In fact, one of the most dangerous things is being too confident. You need to get the right balance of self-confidence and self-doubt and continually be questioning yourself. And that's why when it helps to have a strong board, we had a fantastic board of non-execs around us at the time. So
Derek Cooper was the chairman. Was he chairman yet? He
became chairman. Conrad Strauss was chairman initially, yes. And then Derek became the chairman soon thereafter. But a very, very strong board of people like Elizabeth Bradley and Doug Band and Sir Robert Smith from the UK. So these people added, you know, gravitas and helped you test whatever you were going to do.
And then you embarked on this growth project, and you Standard Bank has been invested on the African continent for many, many years. I think it goes back to the days of Conrad Strauss, maybe even before, when he was MD or chief executive of the bank in the 1970s. And there's this expansion into the African continent, and the stories go around that you were a big admirer of Graham Mackay and SAB, and you looked at their extraordinary growth story and how they'd gone into emerging markets and bought up deficient breweries and put beer into new bottles and grown their markets. And you went, ooh, that'll be a nice to have a piece of that. And then it all sort of came a bit unstuck with the global financial crisis, which changed the world of banking forever.
Yes. If you recall, we were part of Standard Chartered, and they sold us in 1987. So we had been part of a global banking group. And so I think that sense that we had to be more than just the South African bank was always there. And so we did grow into a number of African markets and started an emerging market business headquartered in London and started growing into emerging markets. But as you say, having built a presence in countries like Russia and Argentina and Brazil and Turkey, the financial crisis arrived, and it just became clear that small wholesale banks were not going to survive, and we took the decision to change strategy.
You must be so relieved looking at the politics of those countries and the economies of those countries and the trials and tribulations that they go through. Brazil has been through an enormous crisis. Russia, despite the World Cup now, is always a tenuous place to do business. Turkey has been very, very difficult to do business. I mean, these have been difficult territories for a long time. Are you relieved in retrospect that you managed to extricate Standard Bank from those markets?
I think there's always opportunity in these markets. You know, I think Brazil is, for example, is a market that will always present enormous opportunities. But we were too small, and the notion of being able to have a small bank in a big economy really died after the financial crisis, particularly if you were a wholesale-funded bank. So we made our decision and lived by it. And the new team, or the team that took over, has really capitalized on where we were. And they've really grown the footprint in Africa well and capitalized on the link with China.
When you met Sim Tshabalala for the first time, he came from a business called Real Africa Duralink. Did you see the potential in him almost immediately, or did he have to work to win your trust? That's going to make your next board meeting a bit awkward if you give a bad answer.
Sim is one of the brightest young legal minds, and he came with project finance experience. So he was an investment banker, merchant banker. I met him soon after he joined. I didn't employ him, but I met him soon after he joined. And we, as part of the reshuffle, within a few years, part of the reshuffle, we put him in charge of the African operations, excluding South Africa. So he cut his teeth there and did a great job as a young man.
Our shapeshifter this evening is Jack Emery, the chairman of Liberty, the deputy chairman of Standard Bank. He's a former chief executive of Standard Bank. And his most recent task has been on your behalf, on my behalf, on everybody's behalf, on the instruction or the request of the president to be the special envoy on investment, one of five people given that task to try and drum up some financial support for a South African economy that needs some help. Our shapeshifter this evening is Jack O'Mari, the chairman of Liberty, deputy chair of Standard Bank, and given the task of helping raise a huge amount of money in order to bolster the South African economy. You referred to the opportunity South Africa was given in December with the elective conference at NASREC. It was a close call between South Africa being given another chance to pull itself right, or potentially to slide into further. What's the right word for it? I suppose into disaster. We got that part. Were you worried in the run up to that?
Of course, I think many people hoped that we would have the outcome that we did, but it was close to call. And I think listening to some of your earlier participants on your show this evening, you know, in a number of our big state-owned institutions came perilously close to, you know, to disaster. So, you know, just in time.
Just in time. I mean, is it just in time? Do you think it's soon enough? Can we wrestle the demons away? There are lots of vested interests very keen to keep noses in the trough, and there is the sort of the fight back from the center once again to regain control, almost recapture the state, if you like. It feels like there's still quite a big fight ahead.
Oh, yeah, I don't think this is an easy task that's been given to the likes of Minister Pravin Gordhan. And, you know,
he does seem to be having the time of his life, though.
Exactly. But I think you've got people trying really hard. People are pulling together. And normally in those situations, things do come right. So where there's a will, there's a way. But we've got to capitalize on that the good fortune and the political momentum. And we've got to turn that into a positive economic story, which is why this whole investment drive is so important, because you cannot stop with the political feel-good factor. You've got to turn that into jobs and into growth.
There was a period during the 2000s, if you like, from after the dot-com bubble burst and after 9/11, interest rates in the world went really low. They were low in South Africa, and we had this wonderful period of expansion when jobs were created, when asset values did increase, where South Africans generally did feel wealthier. And that was then unsettled by the global financial crisis. And we really haven't bounced back since then. We've had below population growth figures, which means essentially we've gone backwards for a decade.
We definitely have, certainly in the last 5 years, particularly. So, yes, if you now look, how can you get this flywheel turning? Because that's the real question. How can you get this flywheel turning? You can't rely on the fiscus and the government, because the country's got quite high debt. You can't really rely on the state-owned enterprises to do it, because they're all fighting their own battles. You can't rely on consumer confidence to do it, because the consumer is fairly, on average, fairly highly leveraged already.
Sure.
And so, therefore, you can't expect a consumer boom. You're not going to get an emerging markets boom. Emerging markets are on the retreat. So if you think of it, there's only one lever to pull to get the economic flywheel going, and that is private sector
investment
activity. Yeah. And investment. And so that's why, if growth is important, which it obviously is, because without growth, nothing else is possible, and jobs follow from that, you have to get this investment momentum going if at all possible.
I mean, one just has to watch the testimony of Pravin Gordhan yesterday and Barry Hoare today at the SARS inquiry to realize just how much trust has been eroded in South Africa. When you talk to local business people and you talk to them about investment and expansion, are you getting buy-in, or are you getting a, we'll wait and see, we don't yet trust enough? Yes, there's been a political change, but. Do you get lots of but?
I think one has to separate out foreign investors and local investors. I think on the whole, foreign investors tend to want to see what the local investors are doing, and they do have more of a wait and see approach. And of course, if we're in a competitive world, a company wanting to invest in a plant can choose pretty much anywhere in the world.
Somebody wants to mine. A guy who was at school with me, who's in the mining game, emailed me from Mexico the other day, where he's developing a new gold mining operation. And he says he was in South Africa for 2 years looking for opportunities, and just became too hard. And then with the Zwanek mining code, and he's like, he's not holding much sway in the new mining charter, for example. The reality is there are 207 or 208 countries in the world, and most of them are hungry for money, and the money will go where it's going to get the best return.
Exactly. So it's a risk-return debate, and I think for local companies, it's somewhat different. I think we all know that we've got to get the growth rate in this country up dramatically, otherwise we're going to have all sorts of social problems continuing. And I think there is some sense of duty and a social compact. You can't just rely on government to do this. This has got to be driven by the private sector and led by the private sector. But the private sector doesn't respond to instructions. It responds to a sense of hope and opportunity, and I suppose my job is to encourage companies to take a bit more risk, perhaps, than they would otherwise, and a bit earlier than otherwise.
So what do you say to people? And my SMS line gets filled up on a nightly basis with people who are just getting moodless again, despondent, after a first quarter of huge optimism in which the economy contracted by 2.2%. That's the brutal reality. That, you know, this is, goes beyond euphoria or rumophoria or whatever you call it. This goes to the choices we make for our collective future. And those choices sometimes need to be choices where you commit some capital and take some risk.
Exactly. So we all have a vested interest in this country, and the success of the country is dependent on all our actions. It's not just government.
No.
And so therefore, if we can get the might of the South African business sector to just move a little bit quicker, get the flywheel going, and get some momentum, we can move that growth rate. And
are you using that influence in the boardrooms of Standard Bank and Liberty, where you have got that that sway?
I try not to
have the conflicts of interest
to do that, but I'm seeing the same story to everybody.
So. Yeah, I mean, and where it is. I mean, you're by nature, I think, an optimist. You've got to be an optimist to have been a chief executive in South Africa in tough times. Are we in a short term funk? Can we pull ourselves through?
I think so. I think this country has got so much going for it. You've got to try to look through the fog. You know, so often there have been predictions of doom and gloom, and South Africa has an incredible ability to pull through because of its strong institutions, its great corporate base, the rule of law, certainly contract law, and so on. So I must say I'm optimistic, and I think we'll get through this, but it's going to require a huge effort from everybody.
Is this the retirement you envisaged for yourself?
Did you
figure there was going to be more time than you've actually had at Kenton-on-Sea?
I could never sit at the sea and play golf. I enjoy being active, and I enjoy being involved, and I enjoy making contributions. It's a big difference being retired as a chief executive responsible for the profit and loss and for lots of people to adding value in some way.
I spoke to somebody who saw you on the day, a day or two after you officially retired, and you'd handed over the baton of responsibility, and you went to Standard Bank, and you were wearing a pair of shorts, and you were packing up the last few things in your office. And people said there was just this very clear image of you having had the weight lifted off your shoulders, and you were very, very happy to be taking a breath. Do you feel like that weight has been put back on your shoulders again, or is it a different kind of pressure?
I think it's just different. There's not the same responsibility when you're not responsible for the actual performance of the company and 50,000 employees. It's different making an intellectual and individual contribution.
Jaco Marie, lovely to have you. Thank you so much for coming in. Our shapeshifter this evening, career banker Jaco Marie.